I don't know. No one has had this kind of crazy, wild ride, he says, as we speed away from the brick wall, but in a tone that suggests the ride was an accident. I was influenced a lot by America, he said. The giant six-lane highways, the Empire State Building, the risk-taking. He still remembers vividly the America he heard and read about as a boy in Austria. Everything about it was big. The only reason he set out to grow himself some big muscles was that he thought it might be a ticket to America. If there had not been a popular movement to remove a sitting governor and the chance to run for governor without having to endure a party primary, he never would have bothered. The recall happens, and people are asking me, "What are you going to do?" he says, dodging vagrants and joggers along the beach bike path. I thought about it, but decided I wasn't going to do it. I told Maria I wasn't running. I told everyone I wasn't running. I wasn't running. Then, in the middle of the recall madness, Terminator 3, Rise of the Machines opened. As the movie's leading machine, he was expected to appear on The Tonight Show to promote it. En route, he experienced a familiar impulse, the impulse to do something out of the ordinary. I just thought, this will freak everyone out, he says. It'll be so funny. I'll announce that I am running. I told Leno I was running. And 2 months later, I was governor. He looks over at me, pedaling as fast as I can to keep up with him, and laughs. What the fuck is that? We're now off the beach and on the surface roads, and the traffic is already heavy. He veers left across four lanes of traffic, arrives on the other side, and says, all these people are asking me, what's your plan? Who's on your staff? I didn't have a plan. I didn't have a staff. I wasn't running until I went on Jay Leno. His view of his 7 years trying to run the state of California, like the views of his closest associates, can be summarized as follows. He came to power accidentally, but not without ideas about what he wanted to do. At his core, he thought government had become more problem than solution. An institution run less for the benefit of the people than for the benefit of politicians and other public employees. He behaved pretty much as Americans seem to imagine the ideal politician should behave. He made bold decisions without looking at polls. He didn't sell favors. He treated his opponents fairly. He was quick to acknowledge his mistakes and to learn from them, and so on. He was the rare elected official who believed, with some reason, that he had nothing to lose and behaved accordingly. When presented with the chance to pursue an agenda that violated his own narrow political self-interest for the sake of the public interest, he tended to leap at it. There were a lot of times when we said, "You just can't do that," says his former chief of staff, Susan Kennedy, a lifelong Democrat, whose hiring was one of those things a Republican governor was not supposed to do. He was always like, "I don't care." 90% of the time, it was a good thing. 2 years into his tenure, in mid-2005, he'd tried everything he could think of to persuade individual California state legislators to vote against the short-term desires of their constituents for the greater long-term good of all. To me, they were shocking moments, he says. Having sped past a do not enter sign, we are now flying through intersections without pausing. I can't help but notice that if we weren't breaking the law by going the wrong way down a one-way street, we'd be breaking the law by running stop signs. When you want to do pension reform for the prison guards, he says, and all of a sudden the Republicans are all lined up against you, it was really incredible. And it happened over and over. People would say to me, "Yes, this is the best idea. I would love to vote for it. But if I vote for it, some interest group is going to be angry with me, so I won't do it." I couldn't believe people could actually say that. You have soldiers dying in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they didn't want to risk their political lives by doing the right thing. He came into office with boundless faith in the American people After all, they had elected him, and figured he could always appeal directly to them. That was his trump card, and he played it. In November 2005, he called a special election that sought votes on four reforms: limiting state spending, putting an end to the gerrymandering of legislative districts, limiting public employee union spending on elections, and lengthening the time it took for public school teachers to get tenure. All four propositions addressed, directly or indirectly, the state's large and growing financial mess. All four were defeated. The votes weren't even close. From then until the end of his time in office, he was effectively gelded. The legislators now knew that the people who had elected them to behave exactly the way they were already behaving were not going to undermine them when appealed to directly. The people of California might be irresponsible, but at least they were consistent. A compelling book called California Crackup describes this problem more generally. It's written by a pair of journalists and nonpartisan think tank scholars, Joe Matthews and Mark Paul, and they explain, among other things, why Arnold Schwarzenegger's experience as governor was going to be unlike any other experience in his career. He was never going to win. California had organized itself, not accidentally, into highly partisan legislative districts. It elected highly partisan people to office and then required these people to reach a two-thirds majority to enact any new tax or meddle with big spending decisions. On the off chance that they found some common ground, it could be pulled out from under them by voters through the initiative process. Throw in term limits, no elected official now serves in California government long enough to fully understand it, and you have a recipe for generating maximum contempt for elected officials. Politicians are elected to get things done and are prevented by the system from doing it, leading the people to grow even more disgusted with them. The vicious cycle of contempt, as Mark Paul calls it. California state government was designed mainly to maximize the likelihood that voters will continue to despise the people they elect. But when you look below the surface, he adds, the system is actually very good at giving Californians what they want. What all the polls show, says Paul, is that people want services and not to pay for them. And that's exactly what they have now got. As much as they claim to despise their government, the citizens of California shared its defining trait, a need for debt. The average Californian in 2011 had debts of $78,000 against an income of $43,000. The behavior was unsustainable, but in its way for the people, it works brilliantly. For their leaders, even in the short term, it works less well. They ride into office on great false hopes and quickly discover they can do nothing to justify those hopes. In Paul's view, Arnold Schwarzenegger had been the best test to date of the notion that the problem with California politics was personal, that all the system needed to fix itself was an independent-minded leader willing to rise above petty politics and exert the will of the people. The recall was, in and of itself, an effort by the people to say that a new governor, a different person, could solve the problem, says Paul. He tried every different way of dealing with the crisis in services. He tried to act like a Republican. He tried to act like a Democrat. He tried making nice with the legislature. When that didn't work, he called them girly men. When that didn't work, he went directly to the people, and the people voted against his proposals. The experiment hadn't been a complete failure, as Governor Schwarzenegger was able to accomplish a few important things: reforming worker compensation, enabling open primaries, and at the very end, ensuring that legislative districts would be drawn by an impartial committee rather than by the legislature. But on most issues, and on virtually everything having to do with how the state raised and spent money, he lost. In his first term, Schwarzenegger had set out to cut spending and found he could cut only the things that the state actually needed. Near the end of his second term, he managed to pass a slight tax increase after he talked four Republicans into creating the supermajority necessary for doing so. Every one of them lost his seat in the next election. He'd taken office in 2003 with approval ratings pushing 70%, and what appeared to be a mandate to fix California's money problems. He'd left in 2011 with approval ratings below 25%, having fixed very little. "I was operating under the common sense kind of thing," he says now. "It was the voters who recalled Gray Davis. It was the voters who elected me. So it will be the voters who hand me the tools to do the job." But the other side was successful enough for the voters to take the tools away. David Crane, his economic advisor, at that moment rapidly receding into the distance, could itemize the result, a long list of depressing government financial statistics. The pensions of state employees ate up twice as much of the budget when Schwarzenegger left office as they did when he arrived, for instance. The officially recognized gap between what the state would owe its workers and what it had on hand to pay them was roughly $105 billion. But that, thanks to accounting gimmicks, was probably only about half the real number. This year, the state will directly spend $32 billion on employee pay and benefits, up 65% over the past 10 years, says Crane later. Compare that to state spending on higher education, down 5%, health and human services, up just 5%, and parks and recreation, flat, all crowded out in large part by fast-rising employment costs. Crane was a lifelong Democrat with no particular hostility to government, but the more he'd looked into the details, the more shocking he found them to be. In 2010, for instance, the state spent $6 billion on fewer than 30,000 guards and other prison system employees. A prison guard who started his career at the age of 45 could retire after 5 years with a pension that very nearly equaled his former salary. The head parole psychiatrist for the California prison system was California's highest-paid public employee. In 2010, he had made $838,706. The same fiscal year that the state spent $6 billion on prisons, it had invested just $4.7 billion in its higher education. That is, 33 campuses with 670,000 students. Over the past 30 years, the state's share of the budget for the University of California had fallen from 30% to 11%, and it was about to fall a lot more. In 1980, a Cal student paid $776 a year in tuition. In 2011, he would pay $13,218. Everywhere you turned, the long-term future of the state was being sacrificed. This same set of facts and the narrative it suggested would throw an ordinary man into depression. He might conclude that he lived in a society that was ungovernable. After 7 years of trying and mostly failing to run California, Schwarzenegger is persuasively not depressed. "You have to realize the thing was so much fun," he says. "We had a great time. There were times of frustration. There were times of disappointment, but if you want to live rather than just exist, you want the drama." As we roll to a stop very near the place on the beach where he began his American bodybuilding career, he says, "You have to step back and say, I was elected under odd circumstances, and I'm going out in odd circumstances. You can't have it both ways. You can't be a spoiled brat." The odd circumstances were the never-ending financial crisis. He'd come to power in the bust after the internet bubble. He'd left in the bust after the housing bubble. Before and after our bike ride, I had sat down with him to get his view of this second event, It was in the middle of 2007, he said, when he first noticed something was not quite right in the California economy. He'd been finishing up budget negotiations and arrived at a number, however phony, where the budget could be declared balanced. An aide walked into his office to give him a heads up. The tax receipts for that month were less than expected. We were all of a sudden short $300 million in revenue for the month, says Schwarzenegger. I somehow felt, uh-oh, because there was something in the air. Soon after that, he visited the George W. Bush White House, where he gave a talk that was, as ever, upbeat. At the end of it, this guy, he was the guy who was in charge of housing, I forget the name, great guy. For some reason or other, he was very honest with me, I don't know why. He probably didn't think I'd go out and blab, which I didn't. He says, "That was a great speech you gave, but we're heading to a major problem." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "I looked at some of the numbers, and it's going to be ugly." That's all he said. He wouldn't elaborate. A housing price decline in the United States meant a housing price collapse in California. And a housing price collapse in California meant an economic collapse and a decline in tax revenues. The next month, our revenues came in short $600 million. By December, we were short $1 billion. The hope that California would generate the tax revenues needed to pay for even newly reduced services vanished. This crisis consumed the last 3 years, says Schwarzenegger. All of a sudden, you are pissing off everyone. The parks don't get money, and all of a sudden, everyone is in love with the parks. People pay attention so much to how does it affect them immediately. That's just the way the human mind works. How the further degradation of public services affected people immediately would not have been immediately obvious to a governor sitting in Sacramento. As Meredith Whitney had pointed out, the state has great ability to paper over its financial problems by pushing them down to cities. In May 2011, to take just the most cinematic of countless examples, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld a ruling that California's prison conditions constituted cruel and unusual punishment and violated the Eighth Amendment. The ruling ordered the state either to build more prisons or to release 30,000 inmates. The state, still overpaying its prison guards, has chosen to release the prisoners, and with them, their social cost. There will probably be more crime and heavier dependency on local public services, but it must be paid for by local communities. At some point in our talks, I had asked Schwarzenegger how much time he had spent, as governor, grappling with the on-the-ground local implications of the big state crisis. The question pretty clearly bored him. "I'm not into the local stuff," he'd said. "I was born for the world." About an hour into the weekly meeting of the San Jose City Council, I find myself wishing that I, too, was born for the world. 100 citizens yawn and text as the council honors National Farmers Market Week. The few people who seem to be paying attention get up and leave after the honor is bestowed. The council commemorates August 7 as Assyrian Martyrs Day, honoring the massacre of 3,000 people in August 1933 and recognizing 2,000 years of persecution of Assyrian Christians. Maybe 30 people turn their attention from their cell phones to the ceremony, but then they too rise and exit the chamber. A mere handful of people are left to hear the San Jose city manager offer the latest bleak financial news. The state of California was clawing back tens of millions of dollars more, and 140 employees have been separated from the city. New times call for new euphemisms. A pollster presents his finding that, no matter how the question is phrased, the citizens of San Jose are unlikely to approve any ballot measure that raises taxes. A numbers guy gets to his feet and explains that the investment returns in the city's pension plan are not likely to be anything like as high as was assumed. In addition to there not being enough money in this particular pot to begin with, the pot is failing to expand as fast as everyone had hoped, and so the gap between what the city's employees are entitled to and what will exist is even greater than previously imagined. The council then votes to postpone for 6 weeks a vote on whether to declare the city's budget a public emergency, and thus to give to the mayor, Chuck Reed, new powers. In between each motion, an obese man, not so much dressed as enshrouded in blue jean overalls, maximizes his right to be heard for 5 minutes on every subject. Over and again, he rises from the front row of the audience, waddles to the podium, and delivers sophisticated sounding but incomprehensible critiques of everything. The absolute reduction in competence of government is predicated on what happened today. The relationship between the people and their money in California is such that you can pluck almost any city at random and enter a crisis. San Jose has the highest per capita income of any city in the United States after New York. It has the highest credit rating of any city in California with a population over 250,000. It is one of the few cities in America with a AAA rating from Moody's and Standard & Poor's, but only because its bondholders have the power to compel the city to levy a tax on property owners to pay off the bonds. The city itself is not all that far from being bankrupt. It's late afternoon when I meet Mayor Chuck Reed in his office at the top of City Hall Tower. The crowd below has just begun to chant. The public employees, as usual, are protesting him. Reed is so used to it that he hardly notices. He's a former Air Force fighter pilot and Vietnam veteran with an intellectual bent and the clipped manner of a Midwestern farmer. He has a master's degree from Princeton, a law degree from Stanford, and a lifelong interest in public policy. Still, he presents less as the mayor of a big city in California than as a hard-bitten, upstanding sheriff of a small town who doesn't want any trouble. Elected to the city council in 2000, he became mayor 6 years later. In 2010, he was reelected with 77% of the vote. He's a Democrat, but at this point it doesn't much matter which party he belongs to, or what his ideological leanings are, or for that matter, how popular he is with the people of San Jose. He's got a problem so big that it overwhelms ordinary politics. The city owes so much more money than it can afford to pay to its employees that it could cut its debts in half and still wind up broke. "I did a calculation of cost per public employee," he says as we settle in. "We're not as bad as Greece, I don't think." The problem, he explains, predates the most recent financial crisis. "Hell, I was here. I know how it started. It started in the 1990s with the internet boom. We live near rich people, so we thought we were rich." San Jose's budget, like the budget of any city, turns on the pay of public safety workers. The police and firefighters now eat 75% of all discretionary spending. The internet boom created both great expectations for public employees and tax revenues to meet them. In its negotiations with unions, the city was required to submit to binding arbitration, which works for police officers and firefighters just as it does for Major League Baseball players. Each side of any pay dispute makes its best offer, and a putatively neutral judge picks one of them. There is no meeting in the middle. The judge simply rules for one side or the other. Each side thus has an incentive to be reasonable, for the less reasonable they are, the less likely it is that the judge will favor their proposal. The problem with binding arbitration for police officers and firefighters, says Reed, is that the judges are not neutral. They tend to be labor lawyers who favor the unions, he says, and so the city does anything it can to avoid the process. And what politician wants to spat publicly with police officers and firefighters? Over the past decade, the city of San Jose has repeatedly caved to the demands of its public safety unions. In practice, this meant that when the police or fire department of any neighboring city struck a better deal for itself, it became a fresh argument for improving the pay of San Jose police and fire. The effect was to make the sweetest deal cut by public safety workers with any city in Northern California the starting point for the next round of negotiations for every other city. The departments also used each other to score debating points. For instance, back in 2002, the San Jose Police Union cut a 3-year deal that raised police officers' pay by 10% over the contract. Soon afterward, the San Jose firefighters cut a better deal for themselves, including a pay raise of 23%. The police felt robbed and complained mightily until the city council crafted a deal that handed them 5% more pay in exchange for training to fight terrorists. "We got famous for our anti-terrorist training pay," explains one city official. Eventually, the anti-terrorist training stopped. The police just kept the extra pay with benefits. "Our police and firefighters will earn more in retirement than they did when they were working," says Reed. "There used to be an argument that you have to give us money or we can't afford to live in the city. Now, the more you pay them, the less likely they are to live in the city because they can afford to leave." It's staggering. When did we go from giving people sick leave to letting them accumulate it and cash it in for hundreds of thousands of dollars when they are done working? There's a corruption here. It's not just a financial corruption. It's a corruption of the attitude of public service. When he was elected to the city council in 2000, Reed says, "I hadn't even thought about pensions. I can't say I said, 'Here is my plan.' I never thought about this stuff. It never came up." It wasn't until San Diego flirted with bankruptcy in 2002 that he wondered about San Jose's finances. He began to investigate the matter. "That's when I realized there were big problems," he says. "That's when I started paying attention. That's when I started asking questions. Could it happen here? It's like the housing bubble and the internet bubble. There were people around who were writing about it." It's not that there aren't people telling us that this is crazy. It's that you refuse to believe that you are crazy. He hands me a chart. It shows that the city's pension costs, when he first became interested in the subject, were projected to run $73 million a year. This year, they would be $245 million. Pension and health costs of retired workers now are more than half the budget. In 3 years' time, pension costs alone could come to $400 million, though if you were to adjust for real-life expectancy, it is more like $650 million. Legally obliged to meet these costs, the city can respond only by cutting elsewhere. As a result, San Jose, once run by 7,450 city workers, was now being run by 5,400 city workers. The city was back to staffing levels of 1988, when it had 250,000 fewer residents to service. The remaining workers had taken a 10% pay cut, yet even that was not enough to offset the increase in the city's pension liability. The city had closed its libraries 3 days a week. It had cut back servicing its parks. It had refrained from opening a brand new community center built before the housing bust, because it couldn't pay to staff the place. For the first time in history, it had laid off police officers and firefighters. By 2014, Reed had calculated a city of 1 million people, the 10th largest city in the United States, would be serviced by 1,600 public workers. "There is no way to run a city with that level of staffing," he said. "You start to ask, what is a city? Why do we bother to live together?" But that's just the start. The problem was going to grow worse until, as he put it, you get to one. a single employee to service the entire city, presumably with a focus on paying pensions. I don't know how far out you have to go until you get to one, said Reed, but it isn't all that far. At that point, if not before, the city would be nothing more than a vehicle to pay the retirement costs of its former workers. The only clear solution was if former city workers up and died, soon. But former city workers were, blessedly, living longer than ever. This isn't a hypothetical, scary situation, said Reed. It's a mathematical inevitability. In spirit, it reminded me of Bernie Madoff's investment business. Anyone who looked at Madoff's returns and understood them could see he was running a Ponzi scheme. Only one person who had understood them bothered to blow the whistle, and no one listened to him. See, No One Would Listen, A True Financial Thriller, by Harry Markopoulos. In his negotiations with the unions, the mayor has gotten nowhere. I understand the police and firefighters, he says. They think we're the most important, and everyone else gets fired first. The police union recently suggested to the mayor that he close the libraries for the other 4 days. We looked into that, Reed says. If you close the libraries an extra day, you pay for 20 or 30 cops. Adding 20 more police officers for a year wouldn't solve anything. The cops who were spared this year would be axed next, in response to the soaring costs of the pensions of city workers who already had retired. On the other side of the inequality is the taxpayer of San Jose, who has no interest in paying more than he already does. It's not that we're insolvent and can't pay our bills, says Reed. It's about willingness. I ask him what the chances were that in this pinch he could raise taxes. He holds up a thumb and index finger. Zero. He's recently coined a phrase, he says, service-level insolvency. Service-level insolvency means that the expensive community center that has been built and named cannot be opened. It means closing libraries 3 days a week. It isn't financial bankruptcy. It's cultural bankruptcy. How on earth did this happen? I ask him. The only way I can explain it, he says, is that they got the money because it was there. But he has another way to explain it, and in a moment he offers it up. I think we've suffered from a series of mass delusions, he says. I didn't completely understand what he meant and said so. We're all going to be rich, he says. We're all going to live forever. All the forces in the state are lined up to preserve the status quo, to preserve the delusion. And here, this place, is where the reality hits. On the way back to the elevators, I chatted with two of Mayor Reed's aides. He'd mentioned to me that as bad as they might think they have it in San Jose, a lot of other American cities have it worse. I count my blessings when I talk to the mayors of other cities, he'd say. Which city do you pity most? I asked, just before the elevator doors closed. The aides laughed and in unison said, Vallejo! Welcome to Vallejo, City of Opportunity, reads the sign on the way in. But the shops that remain open display signs that say, We accept food stamps. Weeds surround abandoned businesses, and all traffic lights are set to permanently blink, which is a formality as there are no longer any cops to police the streets. Vallejo is the one city in the Bay Area where you can park anywhere and not worry about getting a ticket, because there are no meter maids either. The windows of City Hall are dark, but its front porch is a hive of activity. A young man in a backwards baseball cap, sunglasses, and a new pair of Nike sneakers stands on a low wall and calls out an address. 900 Cambridge Drive, he says, in Benicia. The people in the crowd below instantly begin bidding. From 2006 to 2010, the value of Vallejo real estate fell 66%. 1 in 16 homes in the city are in foreclosure. This is apparently the fire sale, but the characters involved are so shady and furtive that I can hardly believe it. I stop to ask what's going on, but the bidders don't want to talk. "Why would I tell you anything?" says a guy sitting in a Coleman folding chair. He obviously thinks he's shrewd, and perhaps he is. The lobby of City Hall is completely empty. There's a receptionist desk, but no receptionist. Instead, there's a sign: "To foreclosure auctioneers and foreclosure bidders, please do not conduct business in the City Hall lobby." On the third floor, I find the offices of the new city manager, Phil Batchelor. But when I walk in, there is no one in sight. It's just a collection of empty cubicles. At length, a woman appears and leads me to Batchelor himself. He's in his 60s and, oddly enough, a published author. He's written one book on how to raise children and another on how to face death. Both deliver an overtly Christian message, but he doesn't come across as evangelical. He comes across as sensible and a little weary. His day job before he retired was running cities with financial difficulties. He came out of retirement to take this job, but only after the city council had asked him a few times. "The more you say no, the more determined they are to get you," he says. His chief demand was not financial, but social. He'd only take the job if the people on the city council ceased being nasty to one another and behaved civilly. He actually got that in writing, and they've kept their end of the bargain. I've been in a lot of places that have been in a lot of trouble, but I've never seen anything like this, he says. He then lays out what he finds unusual, beginning with the staffing levels. He's now running the city, and he has a staff of one. I just met her. "When she goes out to the bathroom, she has to lock the door," he says, "because I'm in meetings, and we have no one else." Back in 2008, unable to come to terms with its many creditors, Vallejo had declared bankruptcy. 80% of the city's budget, and the lion's share of the claims that had thrown it into bankruptcy, were wrapped up in the pay and benefits of public safety workers. Relations between the police and the firefighters on the one hand and the citizens on the other were at historic lows. The public safety workers thought that the city was out to screw them on their contracts. The citizenry thought that the public safety workers were using fear as a tool to extort money from them. The local joke was that PD stands for pay or die. The city council meetings had become exercises in outrage. At one, a citizen arrived and tossed a severed pig's head onto the floor. "There's no good reason why Vallejo is as fucked up as it is," says a longtime resident named Mark Garman, who created a website to catalog the Civil War. "It's a boat ride to San Francisco. You throw a stone and you hit Napa." Since the bankruptcy, the police and fire departments had been cut in half. Some number of the citizens who came to Phil Batchelor's office did so to say they no longer felt safe in their own homes. All other city services had been reduced effectively to zero. "Do you know that some cities actually pave their streets?" says Batchelor. "That's not here." I notice on his shelf a copy of Fortune magazine with Meredith Whitney on the cover. As he talked about the bankrupting of Vallejo, I realized that I had heard this story before, or a private sector version of it. The people who had power in the society and were charged with saving it from itself had instead bled the society to death. The problem with the police officers and firefighters isn't a public sector problem. It isn't a problem with government. It's a problem with the entire society. It's what happened on Wall Street in the run-up to the subprime crisis. It's a problem of people taking what they can, just because they can, without regard to the larger social consequences. It's not just a coincidence that the debts of cities and states spun out of control at the same time as the debts of individual Americans. Alone in a dark room with a pile of money, Americans knew exactly what they wanted to do, from the top of the society to the bottom. They'd been conditioned to grab as much as they could, without thinking about the long-term consequences. Afterward, the people on Wall Street would privately bemoan the low morals of the American people who walked away from their subprime loans, and the American people would express outrage at the Wall Street people who paid themselves a fortune to design the bad loans. Having failed to persuade its public safety workers that it could not afford to make them rich, the city of Vallejo, California, had hit bottom. It could fall no lower. "My approach has been, I don't care who is to blame," Batchelor said. "We needed to change." When I met him a few months after he had taken the job, he was still trying to resolve a narrow financial dispute. The city had 1,013 claimants with $500 million in claims, but only $6 million to dole out to them. They were survivors of a shipwreck on a life raft with limited provisions. His job, as he saw it, was to persuade them that the only chance of survival was to work together. He didn't view the city's main problem as financial. The financial problems were the symptom. The disease was the culture. Just a few weeks earlier, he had sent a memo to the remaining city staff, the city council, the mayor, the public safety workers. The central message was that if you want to fix this place, you need to change how you behave, each and every one of you. "It's got to be about the people," he said. "Teach them respect for each other, integrity, and how to strive for excellence. Cultures change, but people need to want to change. People convinced against their will are of the same opinion still." "How do you change the culture of an entire city?" I asked him. "First of all, we look internally," he said. The road out of Vallejo passes directly through the office of Dr. Peter Wybrow, a British neuroscientist at UCLA with a theory about American life. He thinks the dysfunction in America's society is a byproduct of America's success. In academic papers and a popular book, American Mania, Wybrow argues, in effect, that human beings are neurologically ill-designed to be modern Americans. The human brain evolved over hundreds of thousands of years in an environment defined by scarcity. It was not designed, at least originally, for an environment of extreme abundance. "Human beings are wandering around with brains that are fabulously limited," he says cheerfully. "We've got the core of the average lizard." Wrapped around this reptilian core, he explains, is a mammalian layer associated with maternal concern and social interaction, and around that is wrapped a third layer, which enables feats of memory and the capacity for abstract thought. "The only problem," he says, "is our passions are still driven by the lizard core. We are set up to acquire as much as we can of things we perceive as scarce, particularly sex, safety, and food. Even a person on a diet who sensibly avoids coming face to face with a piece of chocolate cake will find it hard to control himself if the chocolate cake somehow finds him. Every pastry chef in America understands this, and now neuroscience does too. When faced with abundance, the brain's ancient reward pathways are difficult to suppress," says Wybrow. "In that moment, the value of eating the chocolate cake exceeds the value of the diet. We cannot think down the road when we are faced with the chocolate cake." The richest society the world has ever seen has grown rich by devising better and better ways to give people what they want. The effect on the brain of lots of instant gratification is something like the effect on the right hand of cutting off the left. The more the lizard core is used, the more dominant it becomes. What we're doing is minimizing the use of the part of the brain that lizards don't have, says Wybrow. We've created physiological dysfunction. We have lost the ability to self-regulate at all levels of the society. The $5 million you get paid at Goldman Sachs if you do whatever they ask you to do, that is the chocolate cake upgraded. The succession of financial bubbles and the amassing of personal and public debt, Wybrow views as simply an expression of the lizard-brained way of life. A color-coded map of American personal indebtedness could be laid on top of the Centers for Disease Control's color-coded map that illustrates the fantastic rise in rates of obesity across the United States since 1985 without disturbing the general pattern. The boom in trading activity in individual stock portfolios, the spread of legalized gambling, the rise of drug and alcohol addiction, it is all of a piece. Everywhere you turn, you see Americans sacrifice their long-term interests for a short-term reward. What happens when a society loses its ability to self-regulate and insists on sacrificing its long-term self-interest for short-term rewards? How does the story end? We could regulate ourselves if we chose to think about it, Wybrow says, but it does not appear that is what we are going to do. Apart from that remote possibility, Wybrow imagines two possible outcomes. The first he illustrates with a true story, which might be called the Parable of the Pheasant. Last spring, on sabbatical at the University of Oxford, he was surprised to discover that he was able to rent an apartment inside Blenheim Palace, the Churchill family home. The previous winter at Blenheim had been harsh, and the pheasant hunters had been efficient. As a result, just a single pheasant had survived in the palace gardens. This bird had gained total control of a newly seeded field. Its intake of food, normally regulated by its environment, was now entirely unregulated. It could eat all it wanted, and it did. The pheasant grew so large that when other birds challenged it for seed, it would simply frighten them away. The fat pheasant became a tourist attraction and even acquired a name, Henry. Henry was the biggest pheasant anyone had ever seen, says Wybrow. Even after he got fat, he just ate and ate. It didn't take long before Henry was obese. He could still eat as much as he wanted, but he could no longer fly. Then one day he was gone. A fox ate him. The other possible outcome was only slightly more hopeful: to hit bottom. To realize what has happened to us, because we have no other choice. If we refuse to regulate ourselves, the only regulators are our environment, says Wybrow, and the way that environment deprives us. For meaningful change to occur, in other words, we need the environment to administer the necessary level of pain. In August 2011, the same week that Standard & Poor's downgraded the debt of the United States government, a judge approved the bankruptcy plan for Vallejo, California. Vallejo's creditors ended up with 5 cents on the dollar. Public employees with something like 20 and 30 cents on the dollar. The city no longer received any rating at all from Moody's and Standard & Poor's. It would take years to build the track record needed to obtain a decent rating. The absence of a rating mattered little, as the last thing the city needed to do was to go out and borrow money from strangers. More out of idle curiosity than with any clear purpose, I drove up again to Vallejo and paid a call on the fire department. In the decay of our sense of common purpose, the firefighters are a telling sign that we are approaching a new bottom. It isn't hard to imagine how a police department might wind up in conflict with the community it's hired to protect. A person who becomes a police officer enjoys the authority. He wants to stop the bad guys. He doesn't necessarily need to care for the people he polices. A person who becomes a firefighter wants to be a good guy. He wants to be loved. The Vallejo firefighter I met with that morning was named Paige Meyer. He was 41 years old. He had short salt and pepper hair and olive skin with traces of burn marks on his cheeks. His natural expression was a smile. He wasn't particularly either religious or political. I'm not necessarily a God guy. The closest thing he had to a religion, apart from his family, was his job. He was extremely proud of it and of his colleagues. "I don't want this to sound arrogant at all," he said, "but many departments in nicer communities, they get a serious fire maybe once a year. We get them all the time." The Vallejo population is older and poorer than in many surrounding cities, and older still are the buildings it lives in. The typical Vallejo house is a charming, highly flammable wooden Victorian. "In this town, we fight fires," says Meyer. "This town rips." The department was shaped by its environment. They were extremely aggressive firefighters. "When I came to this department, you rolled to a fire," he said. "You were not going to see an exterior water stream from this department. We're going in. You have some knucklehead calling in with a sore throat. Your giddy up is not so fast. But I'll tell you something about this department. They get a call that there's a baby choking or a 10-year-old not breathing. You better get out of the way or you're going to get run over." As a young man to pay his way through college, Meyer had worked as a state beach lifeguard at lakes in Central California. He assumed that there would be little drama in the work, but people would turn up, get drunk, and attempt to drown. A few of the times he pulled people from the water, they were in bad enough shape that they needed paramedics. The fire department was there on the spot. He started talking to firefighters and found that they all absolutely loved what they did. "You get to go and live and create a second family. How can you not like that?" He came to Vallejo in 1998 at the age of 28. He had left a cushy job in Sunnyvale, outside San Jose, where there aren't many fires, precisely because he wanted to fight fires. "In other departments," he says, "I wasn't a firefighter. The first 6 months of the job here, I was out at 2 a.m. at a fire every other week. I couldn't believe it." The houses of Vallejo are mainly balloon frame construction. The interior walls have no fire breaks. From bottom to top, all four walls carry fire as efficiently as a chimney. One of the rookie mistakes in Vallejo is to put the fire out on the ground floor, only to look up and see it roaring out of the roof. "When we get to a fire, we say, 'Boom, send someone up to the attic,' because the fire is going right to the attic." Meyer actually had made that rookie mistake. One day, not long after he'd arrived, he'd jumped off the truck, already breathing air from a tank, and raced into what appeared to be a burning one-bedroom apartment. He knocked down the door and put the attack line on the fire and then wondered why the fire wasn't going out. It should have been getting cooler, but it was getting hotter and hotter. Right in front of his face, on his plastic mask, lines trickled down like rain on a windshield. The old-school firefighters left their ears exposed so they could feel the heat. The heat contained the critical information. Meyer could only see the heat. His helmet was melting. "If your helmet starts to shrivel up and melt, that's not cool," he says. A melting helmet, among the other problems it presents, is an indication that a room is about to flash. Flashing, he explains, is when all combustible materials simultaneously ignite. You're a baked potato after that. He needed more water or to get out, but his ego was invested in staying inside, and so he stayed inside. Moments later, a backup arrived with another, bigger hose. Afterward, he understood his mistake. The building was 3 stories, built on a slope that disguised its size, and the fire had reached the attic. "I'm not saying that if the backup hadn't come when it did, I'd be dead," he says. But that's exactly what he is saying. The scar on his face is from that fire. I needed to learn to control my environment, he said. I'd had this false sense of security. When you take care of something, you become attached to it, and he had become attached to Vallejo. He was extremely uncomfortable with conflict between his union and the citizens, and had found himself in screaming matches with the union's negotiator. Meyer thought firefighters, who tended to be idealistic and trusting, were easily duped. He further thought the rank and file had been deceived both by the city, which lied to them repeatedly in negotiations, and by their own leadership, which harnessed the firefighters' outrage to make unreasonable demands in the union-negotiated contract with the city. What was lost at the bargaining table was the reason they did what they did for a living. I'm telling you, Meyer says, when I started, I didn't know what I was getting paid. I didn't care what I was getting paid. I didn't know about benefits. A lot of things that we're politicizing today were not even in my mind. I was just thinking of my dream job. Let me tell you something else. Nobody cared in 2007 how much I made. If I made six figures, they said, "Shit, man, you deserve it. You ran into a burning building." Because everyone had a job. All they knew about our job is that it was dangerous. The minute the economy started to collapse, people started looking at each other. Today, the backup that may or may not have saved him is far less likely to arrive. When Vallejo entered bankruptcy, the fire department was cut from 121 to 67 for a city of 112,000 people. The department handles roughly 13,000 calls a year, extremely high for the population. When people feel threatened or worried by anything except other people, they call the fire department. Most of these calls are the cat-in-the-tree variety, pointless. You never see the skeleton of a cat in a tree. They get calls from people who have headaches. They get calls from people who have itches where they can't scratch. They have to answer every call. The best call I ever had was phantom leg pain in a guy with no legs. To deal with these huge numbers of calls, they once had eight stations, eight three-person engine companies, a four-man truck company, used only for actual fires and rescue calls, one fireboat, one confined space rescue team, and a team to deal with hazardous materials. They now are down to four stations, four engines, and a truck. This is particularly relevant to Paige Meyer because 2 months ago he became Vallejo's new fire chief. It surprised him. He hadn't even applied for the job. The city manager, Phil Batchelor, just called him to his office one day. He didn't ever really ask me if I wanted the job, says Meyer. He just asked, "How's the family?" Told me he was giving me the job, and asked if I had any problem with that. He didn't, actually. He sat down and made a list of ways to improve the department. He faced a fresh challenge: how to deliver service that was the same as before, or even better than before, with half the resources. How to cope with an environment of scarcity. He began to measure things that hadn't been measured. The number one cause of death in firefighting was heart attacks. Number two was a truck crash. He was now in charge of a department that would be both overworked and in a hurry. Fewer people doing twice the work probably meant twice the number of injuries per firefighter. He had decided to tailor fitness regimens to fit the job. With fewer fire stations and fewer firefighters in them, the response times were going to be slower. He'd need to find new ways to speed things up. A longer response time meant less room for error. A longer response time meant the fires they'd be fighting would be bigger. He had some thoughts about the most efficient way to fight these bigger fires. He began, in short, to rethink firefighting. When people pile up debts they will find difficult and perhaps even impossible to repay, they are saying several things at once. They are obviously saying that they want more than they can immediately afford. They are saying, less obviously, that their present wants are so important that to satisfy them it is worth some future difficulty. But in making that bargain, they are implying that when the future difficulty arrives, they'll figure it out. They don't always do that. But you can never rule out the possibility that they will. As idiotic as optimism can sometimes seem, it has a weird habit of paying off.
Boomerang, Travels in the New Third World, was written by Michael Lewis and read by Dylan Baker. Editing and post-production by Frog Pond Productions. The associate producer was Jenna Weiss-Berman. It was directed by Jan Werner and Tara Thomas. Boomerang was produced by Tara Thomas. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Also from Simon & Schuster Audio, The Big Short, Inside the Doomsday Machine by Michael Lewis, read by Jesse Boggs and Michael Lewis.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.